Answering your tough financial questions for the past 21 years, it's Hanson McLean's Money Matters with co-hosts Scott Hanson and Pat McLean. Would you like an opinion on a financial matter you're dealing with? Whether it is about retirement, investments, taxes, or 401ks, Scott Hanson and Pat McLean would like to help you by answering your call. To join Hanson McLean's Money Matters, call now at 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON.
Welcome to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
I'm Pat McLean.
And glad you are with us today. By the way, Hanson McLean, that name is being transitioned to Allworth Financial. We're still here. We're not going anywhere. We're going to still continue doing the program. Pat and I are still co-CEOs with the organization.
As we continue to grow,
we're using a name that's a little more... describes a little more who we are and what we do, and not a couple guys' names on the door.
And I hope I actually get to do this as long as people are willing to listen to it.
The program?
Yeah. I kind of like it.
Well, you must. You wouldn't be doing it for 24 years.
That's a good point.
That is?
20?
Yeah.
24 years.
Yeah, about 24 years.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, glad you're here with us as we talk about...
money.
And ourselves. We talk about ourselves. Like we are now. I hope people still want to hear me. What do you think about me?
That's true. Is it pretty self-absorbed?
That's right. I hope still be doing it.
But I did say as long as they're willing to listen, so I brought them into the equation to talk about me.
It wasn't as long as I continued to still add value to others.
Well, they listen to it, or there'd be no value added.
It's just comic relief.
I hope it's more than that.
Okay. I hope so, too. Anyway, if you want to join the program, we got a question for us. We would love to take your phone call. And to join us, 1-888-2-HANSON, 1-888-2-HANSON. We'll get you on the program. And Ezra, it's the taxes are due in about 10 days or so.
Good times. Don't be afraid to file an extension.
That's all we're going to say. If you have not, if you're not
If you're scrambling... figure out what you think your tax bill will be, pay it, and then file an extension and bring it all home in the next few months when your tax preparer isn't burdened.
Yeah, and just take a guess at what your tax bill is.
You got to get pretty close. Or overpay it a little bit.
It's not going to... Actually, the interest charges, because interest rates have been so low, IRS interest charges have been low, too.
If you have the money, just overpay it a little bit, because the money that you're earning in your savings account isn't...
not much either.
So it's kind of a push.
Yeah. And it's cheaper. I mean, the interest rate they will charge you is more than what you can earn. Make that... we would encourage you to make that... So, anyway, let's go right off to the calls here. We're in Greenville, South Carolina with David. David, you're with Hanson McLean, soon to be Allworth's Money Matters.
Yes. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I've received some of your books in the past on retirement planning and so forth. My wife is retired at age 62. I'm still working. I'm age 67, and I would like to max my Social Security at age 70.
Okay.
My question is, at age 70, when I sign up for Social Security, if I continue to work to that age, how do I go about investigating the spousal benefit for my wife? As an example, right now, she's getting around. She's always only worked part time through her working career, and as she was home raising her children and helping with her parents and grandchildren and so forth. My question is, how do we go about with the Social Security office, SocialSecurity.gov, to actually change her own benefit that she's receiving now to a spousal benefit?
Okay, so that's an easy part. But let's step back for a second, David. How much is she receiving on a monthly benefit now?
She's receiving about $650 a month.
And if you were to apply for Social Security today, how much would you be getting a month?
Today, I'd be around $2,500 today.
And if you waited till age 70 and a half, how much would you get?
I'm a little short of 3,000.
Or 70, I'm sorry, 70. How much did you get?
I think I'm a little short of 3,000, 2,990 or something like that.
So even if you file a restricted claim today because she's under 66, it's not going to help her. Is that right, Pat?
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe it makes sense for him to go on.
She's 69 right now.
Oh. She's 69. I thought you said she...
Well, she retired.
She retired at 62, and she's 69 now.
Why don't you file and suspend? She can receive half years today.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not claiming today, though.
I know.
But you file, and then you sign up for it, and then you say, oh, wait, no, I don't want it. And by doing that, it's like you hadn't filed. But what it triggers is it allows her to start receiving 50% of your benefit.
Oh, okay. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, and the rules just changed. Okay. So she had to have been born before January 1st of 1954. So it's those that are 66 and older this year. You
it
both
only
do.
Applies to them.
Okay.
So
she was born in 49.
Yeah. So David, so you want to go into the Social Security Administration?
And if you've looked at some of our on our website, we've got a Social Security guide of some sort. I forget what it's called, but it sounds like you're education.
Yeah. Have you been to our website? Correct, David.
Not recently.
Yeah, okay. But there's one on Social Security. You can spend a few minutes, 30 minutes or whatever, and it'll bring you up to date on how this works.
So what you want to do is it does exactly what you wanted to do. In fact, this call is much better than you had hoped for, which is file and then you suspend, but it lets her get on your benefit right now. Your benefit, because you suspended, continues to grow until you're age 70, like it was.
Okay.
And we actually, frankly, should have done this before.
Right. Okay.
But you want to do it as quickly as possible. And it's called file and suspend. Okay. So for the rest of the listeners, this may not apply to you. It's just a quirk. They changed the rules. Rules. So.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Man.
All right. Wish you well.
Appreciate you taking my call and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate it. Let's continue on. We are talking to Lou and Christina. Lou and Christina, you're with Scott Hanson and Pat McClain, Allworth Financial.
Thank you. Well,
I feel like a Dr. Laura or something to get husband and wife on. She's still around?
Yeah. Don't you listen? All right. What can we do for you, Lou and Christina?
Well, I was listening to your show last week, and you talked about how you want to try to find somebody who's a fiduciary. Well, what happened this last year is we had somebody that we were investing through, and the person was a fiduciary, and we had been with him for 30 years, and what ended up happening, make a long story short, is that he ended up embezzling, and all of our funds were depleted.
All of our liquid assets were taken.
Oh.
And so learned about this because we live on investment income that comes every month, and it didn't. Anyhow, so the question is, he was a fiduciary and had been our advisor for 30 years. And the question is, you know, what benefit does a fiduciary get me? So far we've gone to the FBI. The FBI is involved, obviously. Gone to find out if he's got any insurance and been told no, that it doesn't cover theft. Gone to our insurance, and they are offering us a whopping $2,500. So the first question is our recourse, and the second question is, in the future, how can we protect ourselves?
So there's two things, right? A fiduciary means that they are supposed to put
just a legal duty. That's all that means.
But that doesn't stop someone from embezzling money from you.
They broke that law as a fiduciary, as they broke the law of embezzlement.
Listen, you can't do a good deal with a bad person. What helps is where you
30 years.
Where you custody, right? Where you custody the assets. So a good firm will custody outside themselves. In fact, it's one of the telltale signs of someone that is running an embezzlement scheme is that they will tell you that they self-custody, right?
Most people don't even know what that means. It just means where the money's. Like firms like ours, we use third party independent, like a Charles Schwab, Fidelity, TD Ameritrade.
And you give us the ability to make changes in the account on your behalf.
But not the ability to take money and withdraw.
Right? And you have the ability to view the account online every day. There are all sorts of safeguards there. My guess is when this person stole from you, they actually were creating their own statements and they held the assets. They said they held the assets themselves. Is that correct?
Well, the assets were supposed to be in a bank. I forget the name of the bank, but in a bank. But in fact, I believe you're right. That's what happened. I thought after 30 years.
You didn't question anything.
That is a long, long Ponzi scheme. That is. So who else do you know of that he has stolen from?
There were apparently 15 other investors in this situation.
That's for a 30-year scheme. That actually is not a big number of.
Well, maybe it wasn't 30 years. Maybe it's 29. He was honest and.
Yeah, and then the last one he fell apart. Did he make changes in the account in the last few years? Did he move from a broker dealer? Was he at a broker dealer and then he went on his own? Anything like that?
No.
And who did on the statements? Who sent the statements? What did it look like?
Statements. I got statements both from him as well as from the bank.
Okay, we're going someplace. What did the statements on? Is the statements at the bank, were they addressed? Did they have your name on it?
No, they had the name of the LLC that the investment came out of, or was put into.
So you owned part of an LLC with him.
You were a limited partner with him.
Yeah. Yes. So he wasn't acting as a fiduciary to you. He was acting as
technically, if you're the managing member of a limited partnership, you've got a fiduciary responsibility to your partners.
But not acting as an RIA, not as a registered investment.
No.
He could have been both, though. Was he a registered investment advisor?
He was. But so here's the first part of the question is, what recourse do I have? And then the question is, moving forward, assuming we have assets, we know some of the things to look out for.
So let's answer the second thing first. So the first thing you want to do is if you go to a firm, is you want to know where they custody. So, which means TD Ameritrade, Charles Schwab, Fidelity, Pershing,
and then
Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, they all custody.
The second thing is, only invest in things that are publicly traded, things that you can turn into cash tomorrow.
That price.
If you own a portfolio of government bonds, Chevron stock, Apple stock, whatever, right? Or Vanguard funds, you know that you can cash those in at any day and receive your cash.
Okay, so that's the answer to the second question. The first question is, what recourse do you have? Well, you have civil recourse, assuming this person has any assets, right? So in total, how much money did this person steal from, you believe, these 15 people?
Well, $2 million from me.
Okay.
And we believe that the other investors invested a minimum of $1 million. The FBI says that's not true. I don't know. Pick a number.
So what happens is, so there's two tracks that you run on. One is criminal and the other is civil. So,
right.
We'll go back to the largest Ponzi scheme in recent history, or maybe even ever, which is Bernie Madoff. So Bernie Madoff went to prison on a criminal charge, but he was sued civilly. And what that meant is that a group of people got together and sued Bernie Madoff and family. And said,
and they keep finding money.
Well, yes, it's almost done, but they disgorged money from other people that took money out of the Ponzi scheme that really shouldn't have. So that was disgorged. They went back to investors and said, you put in $100,000, but you got $300,000 out. But at the end of the day, you shouldn't have gotten that $300,000. So you need to give us back $150,000. They disgorged it. They took all his personal assets. They took all the assets of the family. They left Ruth with a little bit of money, the ex-wife. They took it from his sons. So what happens is you need to create a civil, you need to go after them civilly.
Yeah.
And the first thing a civil attorney is going to do is to try to figure out whether this guy has any money, whether it was hidden, whether it was offshore, whether there's a cabin up in, you know, Idaho, wherever. And then if he or she, that attorney, believes there's assets there, they'll probably take the case as a percentage of recovery is normally how they work. And they go out and they get all these people that got ripped off by this and they file a civil lawsuit and then they disgorge the money from that person. That's the methodology. If there's no money there, you know, as my mom always used to say, when I was growing up, you can't get blood from a stone, which I think meant.
I always heard you can't get blood out of a turnip.
Oh, that's right. You can't get water out of a stone. You can't get blood out of a turnip. I think that's a way of saying.
I think Moses got water from the stone. But anyway, that's another story.
Okay. So you can't get blood out of a turnip, which means if there's nothing there, there's nothing there, right? But the first thing you need to do is determine if there's anything there. And it actually probably should have started already, the civil lawsuit, as quickly as you found out, because it gave this person less time to move money around. Although if there's criminal proceedings against this person, there's probably not a lot of movement. And oftentimes the law enforcement will actually tell you where the money went. Right. So civilly.
So going forward, we're going to sell a piece of real estate, and we're probably going to have around $4 million to start looking at trying to do something with.
I got to tell you, I feel much better because my heart. I'm thinking your life savings. I'm thinking how are you going to eat now. So I'm glad to hear you have some other assets.
Yeah. You have other assets.
Yeah, we do.
I mean, it's horrible. Right. Horrible. Don't get me wrong.
It is horrible. We're very fortunate that we had some other things to fall back on, but I've listened to you before, and you've talked about how because right now obviously we are real gun shy and we don't want to get in
as you should be.
And again, we want to try to protect the majority of what we're going to be investing forward, but also willing to try to do something that's going to make us a little bit money. In that vein, looking at around $4 million, what would your thoughts
see
be?
What happened in your situation is, even though you might have had he sold you a limited partnership LLC
of which he was probably the general partner,
and you were a limited partner,
which means you had to follow him wherever he went. Now he ended up stealing the money from the limited partnership, maybe. Or maybe he lost it all. We don't know. There's a difference.
So I would only invest in securities that can be traded, that have an open market, and with an independent custodian, a large firm that you know the brand of, right, that you're comfortable and confident in.
And what that means is if let's say that we built a portfolio here at Hanson McLean. We built a portfolio here at our firm of holdings. If you were unhappy with us, you don't have to actually sell those holdings. You could transfer it to someone else. You just fire us, right? We're just as a consultant on the portfolio. In fact, if we house those at Fidelity or TD Ameritrade or Schwab, you didn't even have to move the money. You could just fire us and put another consultant on it, or not fire us. You could become your own consultant on it.
That's right.
But those assets are held outside of our firm. It sounds like you were a member of a limited partnership, and maybe the bank holds some responsibility for this.
They might.
The bank may hold some responsibility for this, and that's what a civil attorney would be able to tell you.
They might have some liability
here. In your situation, then you would put a risk profile together and invest accordingly on something that you could sell at a moment's notice. So that's what I would look at. So you need to do two things. You want to contact a civil attorney, and then you want to actually meet with your tax preparer to figure out what the deductibility of this loss will be against the other income, including the sale of this property.
Yeah, because it might,
including the sale
year.
Of this property.
Taxes again.
What did you say?
we're never going to pay taxes again.
Well, so you've already started that process. So, all right, appreciate the call.
You know what? I gotta tell you, the fact that you guys are both kind of laughing and finding the best, we're never paying taxes again, that is quite refreshing because this is a horrible thing to happen. And
it's money, and then you feel betrayed, obviously.
Yeah, obviously betrayed.
And this person needs to go to prison.
Of course.
For a long, long, long time, right? Long time. And you need to find any assets. Bernie Madoff, one of the largest schemes in history, Ponzi schemes, they're still finding assets. And they're still disgorging
them. Yeah, they just distributed some recently.
Distributing some recently, yes. Yeah.
And 10 years later.
That took place civilly, not criminally. So.
But we feel like we got our health, you know, and we try to keep a positive attitude.
Yeah, you have a great
attitude. Well, attitude. You know what?
It's a lot worse.
Yeah, and if you focus on all the bad things in life and the anger you have over people that have stabbed you in the back, you probably die a young age, a bitter man.
You'll become angry, and I know.
All right.
Yeah, if we focus on this, we're not focusing on solving the problem, and we need to solve the problem and look forward. So
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, still go after that money that's rightfully
yours.
A
good attorney will actually do a lot of research at no cost to figure out if there's money there.
Yeah, because they'll share in the...
You
definitely get one on contingency and something like this.
So appreciate the call.
Yeah, good luck to you guys.
Unfortunately, I've seen it... there's telltale signs that a good advisor could actually see a Ponzi scheme in
invest in an investment that your advisor has put together. One of the things we've talked about, we don't create our own products here. It's just that level of independence again.
Yeah.
So people don't have to worry about
this. If the advisor, if the person is building their own products and then they're managing them, that you can see it. You can see it. Where the statements are coming from, how the assets are priced, what the story behind it is. Right now, guy from the neighborhood asked if I would talk to him about an investment he made. So I said, sure. And he said, well, I need you to sign a non-disclosure agreement before we talk about it. And I said, are you trying to sell me something? He said, no. This is an investment I made in another company, but I can't talk about it unless you sign a non-disclosure agreement. And I said, well, then I don't want to talk about it.
It's like, why am I going to sign a non-disclosure agreement?
I don't. You came to me.
That's a lot to ask of you, right?
So he said, okay, well, maybe you don't. And I said, well, I don't care. So anyway, he brought it to me. He said, well, this company
without signing the NDA.
Yeah, okay. Correct. He goes, I invested with this company and it's an energy efficiency.
Oh, yeah.
It's green.
Of course, green.
It's green. It's
socially responsible.
It's some, and it hit four of the five, it had something to do with water conservation, use of the sun. And he said, they're trying to raise more money, but they really, and so we walked through it together and I said, first of all, you shouldn't give them any more money. And second of all, you probably got scammed because just the story alone and the reporting coming back to him was non-existent.
It's a private investment, right?
Private investment. But the story, he clicked all the boxes, high returns, low risk, green energy, solar, water conservation, charity, kids in Africa. I mean,
the animal shelter.
It went through the box and it clicked every one of them. Like this guy that was selling this thing didn't miss a single button.
Well, yeah. I mean, you got
to. Yeah, you got to be careful.
Yeah. All right. So before we take a break here, Pat. We were talking before the show.
Yes.
About, and we were like, do we talk about this? We
actually said, is it right?
Should we bring this up on the air?
But it's a classic study in economics of supply and demand.
Yes.
And this is why we're going to talk about it. It happens to do with marijuana in the state of California.
Yes. The cannabis industry.
The cannabis industry. Hi. So I found this interesting because this is what, when this all became legal or so-called legal or partially legal or whatever it is, I thought this market is going to soar. And then all of a sudden you see these offerings of Canadian marijuana companies and clients calling and saying,
you hear radio ads about investing in them.
So here's I read this article a couple of weeks ago, but I wanted to share it with you. In 2019, in the state of California, they expect 1,142 acres of cultivation of marijuana. They expect, they're projecting, around 9 million pounds of marijuana will be produced in the state of California. You're thinking, all right, it's a lot of marijuana. Right? And I'm not talking whether I like it or don't like it. So I'm not there. But I don't, by the way. But you can do whatever you want with yours. So they expect that the consumption in the state of California that will be sold will be between 1.8 million and 2.2 million pounds.
So they're producing how many pounds?
9 million pounds. And they expect, this is the year the year 2019, that the maximum the market could absorb is 2.2 million pounds.
All right. Hey, we're going to actually take a quick break. But this is a good, you're going to stick around, because whether it's this industry or some other industry, here's some red flags for you before you make some investments. So stick around. More Hans McLean, Allworth Financial, just a moment.
Wondering if you're on track with your financial matters? Call now at 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON.
Welcome back to Money Matters. Scott Hansen.
Pat McLean.
And before we took this break, we were talking about the cannabis industry.
And
this is supply and demand is what you're going after, right?
Supply. You see it in the wine industry. You see it in peaches. You see it in almonds. You see it in pistachios. You see it in cattle. You see it in almost any commodity. You see it in gold, right? You see it across the board, which is if the price goes up, it draws new capital. You see it in stocks.
Right? Yes, of course. Price goes up. Hey, look at this.
Easy money. It draws more capital. As more capital comes in, what happens to the price?
Price goes down.
The price goes down. There is a lack of supply, and then there is oversupply, right?
Yes.
Unless you get some sort of government program in there that actually controls it.
Lack of supply looks like a phenomenal investment opportunity to people. Investors dump in, capital flows there until there's suddenly an oversupply. What happens then?
Prices drop.
Prices plummet, and a lot of people get washed out. And then
the cycle starts again. But, and a lot of times that industries will find equilibrium at some point in time, but there's always spikes around the equilibrium. Yeah. Marijuana, 9 million pounds.
Production is expected in 2019 for California to produce how many pounds?
9 million pounds. But the expected consumption in the state of California is 2.2 million pounds.
So it looks to me like California needs to have a big campaign to get people to consume more marijuana.
So what has happened,
that's my
what they assume has been happening, is that this marijuana has been exported illegally into the states that it's not legal
you
to smoke
think?
Marijuana.
No way. You think... Pots. By the way, I was in Rosarito, Tijuana, Mexico, in January of this year. I went down with a group of financial executives to do a 2-day home build. We were down there for 2 days doing a home build, and that one evening we went to there's a bar right there called Plan B. It's owned by an American guy. A guy who grew up in the Sacramento region actually runs the bar down there, and so we're having a conversation like, who lives here? Who has these beachfront homes? They're all Americans, of course. But then we're talking about drugs, and he says, "No, the pot." This is in Tijuana. The marijuana comes from California. Oh, he says California is where they have the good stuff.
Oh, they're apparently exporting it into Mexico.
Correct. That's what he told me.
We better build that wall.
I thought it was...
So this is why they think this is going to change.
And by the way, I was not that we were looking for the marijuana. It was
okay. But why they think this is going to change is because the regulations in the state of California are now putting into place what they call track and trace, which is if you're growing marijuana legally, you need to be able to track it from seed to retailer in order to sell it. So it's going to make the exporting it to other states more difficult if you're following the laws.
That's right.
Where up until now, it hasn't been. So all those people that got excited about investing in marijuana a year ago.
There's not a chance in the world I would recommend doing that.
Not, no.
Not forget the moral or whatever. Just from a pure economic standpoint, it's too overhyped. There's going to be a lot of capital loss there. People are going to lose their life savings.
And you still can't bank it.
Yeah. Anyway, let's take some calls here. Let's go to California and talk with Craig. Craig, you're with Hans McLean, soon to be Allworth Financial's Money Matters.
Hi, Scott and Pat. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I got a question about retirement planning. It's actually a three-part question. Here's a little background.
Perfect.
My wife and I are retired. We currently have $3.7 million in retirement accounts. About 90% of that is equities. We are also receiving 2 5-year pension payouts. That will be about $4 million when all is said and done. Most of that is qualified. We're rolling it to IRAs. So my question is it appropriate today from an asset allocation standpoint to consider that that yet-to-be-received pension payout is really a fixed income instrument,
yeah,
in which case I'm about 50-50?
Assuming it's, in fact, guaranteed and
that you
fixed
could,
and you're going to receive.
And that you could roll it over sounds
what,
funky
it,
to
it,
me.
It's not a non-qualified deferred comp plan then?
No.
It's paid out over 5 years, and it's $4 million. And
it's qualified pension.
And you can roll it to an IRA.
Most of it. A portion of it is non-qualified.
All right, so you understand how it all works.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then,
but it's a guaranteed amount that you're getting paid. It's not like an ESOP that's being distributed or something.
No. It's guaranteed and it's got a COLA, too. So the next part of this is...
Well, there's no question you could say, I've got this guaranteed income coming in, $4 million. It's guaranteed. It's fixed. I know exactly what the dollar amount. I know the timing. Yeah, that is, by definition, fixed income. And so your other roughly $4 million being almost all equities, you got a 50-50 split.
Okay. Actually, yeah, you're about 45-55.
Okay.
Assuming you don't go crazy if the $3.7 million falls in value to $2.8
million. Yeah.
No one's going to like it. But over the long term,
it's the appropriate allocation.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Was that the first question?
That was the first question.
Okay,
the next one is, I have so much in this tax-deferred arena.
Yeah.
I want to consider a Roth conversion strategy. I've done some modeling, and it seems that when I'm 90, God willing, I will have more wealth and more in Roth accounts if I do this to the 24% tax bracket.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that?
Assuming you're going to continue to live in the state of California, if you plan on moving to a lower tax rate state, that you may want to defer any of the conversion.
I see. Yeah, not planning on moving it this time, but
okay.
And so then the last question is, if this Roth conversion strategy is sound, how does that affect the Social Security claiming strategy? Still 62, wait.
Your income is going to be from the pension. Well, the pension is ultimately. What's your taxable income going to be for 2019?
About $100,000.
Okay. So, yeah, it's not going to. And you plan on never working again?
That's the plan.
And how old did you say you were?
I didn't. I'm 57. My wife is 56.
Oh, okay. Oh. So I'm going to ask you to not really worry about when to claim Social Security at this point in time.
Okay.
Because.
But if you were marching on Social Security and you had $8 million in retirement plans, you'd take it as soon as you can get it.
Yes, I'd take it early. Only because my expectation is that at some point in time, they're going to have to start either means testing Social Security benefits based upon income, and which they already have, by the way. They've just done it in a backdoor method of taxing Social Security benefits at certain incomes and not at others, which is a form of means testing. But the reason it's 5 years off and 6 years off, a lot can happen in the next five to 6 years.
Okay.
But you might find you're earning some income somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And you might.
I don't know anything about you, but I figured you're some sort of a business leader to accumulate $8 million in retirement plans. You're probably recently. You're recently retired. Well, you're recently retired.
You're young.
You might find yourself. I'm not saying you're going to go back in the same kind of grinding career you probably came, but you might find yourself in some sort of area that is spinning off some sort of self-employment or wage income. So that's going to be
minus that. You should start the conversion to Roth IRAs.
Okay.
Because you model this thing out and what these plans are worth at 70.5, and your required minimum distributions at that point.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a problem.
It's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the call.
Thanks for calling. Sounds like you got these are.
Yeah.
It's not very often you see someone with these larger retirement plan balances.
Yeah.
Particularly at.
Must have been a doctor or something like that. At this age, 56.
Doctors don't save that well.
Sorry.
Well, some of them do.
Some of them do.
But that's an unusual number to have in there. I do question whether you could roll that $4 million into an IRA, but I'm going to take his word for it.
Yeah, because pension plans
are paid out over a five-year period. And it was non-qualified. It was a qualified.
Small, could have been small employer.
Maybe.
Set up some sort of
Profit sharing of some sort.
Yeah, some plan that was age weighted, whatever they call those things. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. 1-888-2-HANSON is our number to be part of our program. That's 1-888-2-HANSON. We are in New Jersey with Rick. Rick, you're with Hanson McLean.
Yeah, how you doing?
Hi, Rick.
I got two questions. One is about Roth conversions and whether to contribute to a Roth or a regular 401k.
Okay.
Between me and my wife, we have about $400,000 in IRAs, which I converted $50,000 last year. We have a small business between W-2 and K-1. It puts off about $300,000 a year. This is the first year we're doing the 401k. We were doing a simple before that. And I want to convert up to the 24% tax bracket, whatever I have available. And I don't know if I should still continue to convert this year.
What was your income last year when you converted the $50,000?
$300,000.
My accountant figured it out that by the time I take the 20% off the the company profited, which was like $180,000. And
are you going to stay in New Jersey long term?
Probably.
You don't plan on moving to Florida like everyone else?
No, that's the goal. At least 6 years in a day. 6 months in a day.
I mean, the reason we're asking, because New Jersey is one of the top three tax states, right, in the country. So when you do a Roth conversion, you're choosing, you got 400,000 retirement plans, you are choosing to give the state of New Jersey some tax dollars on that you would not give to New Jersey if you were a resident of Florida. So if, in fact, part of your plan or part of your dream is to one day live in Florida, whether it's full-time or 7 months out of the year, we would say, don't bother converting.
And it's questionable whether you should convert an income of that high anyway.
Because what, Jersey, you're about 9% top rate, somewhere in there?
Yep, exactly. But in New Jersey, I believe when you put into a traditional IRA, you don't get a tax deduction for it. You get a tax deduction if you contribute to a 401k, but not to an IRA. So I believe when I'm converting, I'm not going to pay state tax on it.
I don't know that.
Converting, you mean you're not paying a state tax on a conversion of a 401k right now?
Because you never...
No.
I don't know that.
Yeah,
I don't know that.
I don't know that.
No, the 401k is just first started this year.
I have never read anywhere.
So what's your question? So we're going to defer to your accountant for this because of the intricacies of that state law.
I mean, and if your accountant believes it's a good idea, usually accountants are...
Maybe he's a little shaky, to be honest. I don't know if I got the right guy.
Well, okay. So on the surface, on the surface, when you said your income was $300,000 and you converted $50,000 due to an RA, Scott Hanson and I just looked at each other like,
why would you do that?
Right?
Well, I kept it in the 24% tax bracket.
Right, but even at the 24% tax bracket, the way it works is, first of all, it's progressive tax. So there's some that's
marginal rate.
Some that's not taxed at all. Some it's taxed at lower rates. But as our income gets higher, we also start losing our itemized deductions. So our effective rate could actually be higher than these listed capital gains rates on those next dollars converted. And
the way you do it is you model the tax. The easiest way to do is to model the tax return.
If you had, if it was $4 million or $40 million in retirement accounts, it would be one thing. But
it's $400,000, so we're not really worried about your required minimum distribution at age 70 and a half. So on the surface, I question.
It's a head scratcher.
Yeah. When you said that, we just looked at each other like, well, I'd like to hear the philosophy behind this.
Because I'm not convinced.
Well, we plan on putting in about $80,000 a year for the next 10, 12 years into the 401k. So I figured I'm going to be over, you know.
But you're putting but 40 in and then taking 50 out.
What's the point? Why didn't you set up a 401k that allows just a Roth contribution and not even go through the exercise if, in fact,
well,
that's what
I did?
Well,
I did for this year. I started it this year.
So I don't even know if that's the right thing for you to do.
I wouldn't.
I'd take the deduction. Correct. I would take the deduction.
Okay.
So
we're in high tax California.
Yeah.
I probably will be here the rest of my life, but you never know.
We're beating you guys. Congratulations, California. but you answered your own question by saying that you're not 100% confident in your CPA's ability.
Yes.
I'm just thinking if you, Rick, sat around a table of 10 advisors, certified financial planners and CPAs, I bet I would have trouble thinking one or two would advise. It's a crapshoot. Nobody knows the future, right? But if we look at probabilities, risk mitigation, I can't think of many people that would recommend converting 50 grand to a Roth.
No, and I can't think of many people that would actually say make a contribution to a Roth.
No, not at your income level.
Not at your income level.
Okay.
So
if you're at $30,000 a year, it'd be an easy one.
You need to go find a new accountant or a new financial advisor or probably both. Who helped you set up the 401k?
It's an advice. You know, it's through a zero price.
Okay.
You know, through them.
So the mere fact that you're moving from a simple to a 401k now means you're a little bit behind the times.
Well,
true. I got a small my company's small, you know, and.
Well, all companies start small.
Yeah.
Right? That's how things start. All right. Appreciate the call.
Rick, yeah. Glad you called.
You got it.
All right. And remember, what brought you, and when you're running a company, what brought you here won't get you there or you'd be there, which means the same advisors that brought you to the date, to the place you are today, may not be the same advisors you need in the future. Because sometimes you outgrow the competency of the people that you're taking advice
from. Well,
it
sounds like he already is questioning his account. A little shady, I think is what he said.
Yeah.
You don't want to shake. You don't want to shake your account.
It's actually the name of the firm is Shaky and Shady.
Shaky and Shady. A division of Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe.
Yes. We're that close is their motto. I appreciate the call.
Yeah. Lynch and Burnham.
there you go. So anyway.
And we'll continue on. We're in Elk Grove, California. We're talking with Vince. Vince, you're with Money Matters.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Hi, Vince. We're great. Thanks for joining us.
Well, I listen to your show on podcasts every week, and so I get a lot of great advice. So
I wanted
to share my thoughts where I'm at right now, especially with the market changing the last couple of weeks, and just wanted to get your feedback.
So, all right.
I'm 65 years old, married, and I expect to work until I'm 70. Number one goal is to pay off our primary residence, which would be in the next 5 years. A primary residence, and we also have some rental property, is worth just a little bit over $1 million. And these two properties are our only form of debt, which is about $490,000. My wife and I, we both have about $195,000 in retirement accounts, of which about $120,000 is in 401ks and then $70,000 in IRA accounts.
So that's each one of you have approximately $195,000?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So the 401k is invested 100% into the Vanguard Target Retirement 2025. And then we also have about $100,000 in cash saved. So, you know, regarding our annual retirement savings, you know, I'm maxing out my 401k at the $25,000 a year. And then we're, you know, adding an additional $20,000 a year in savings. So if all goes as planned, you know, the goal will be to sell our rental property in 5 years and use the equity. Our equity from the payoff to pay off our primary residence at retirement. So, you know, that, you know,
is that calculating some increase in the value of the rental?
That's actually at the current value of the rental. And I think I had scheduled in about 3 to 4% annual increase.
And is the rental are you cash flow positive on the rental now?
Yes. Yeah, it's about a 6 to 7% return on investment, and over the next 5 years, the actual income that we receive is offset by the depreciation.
Yeah. Okay.
So you know.
So what's the question for us?
So I guess the question is, you know, I've heard, especially in the last couple of weeks, and I know everybody's situation is different depending on their position with their retirement accounts, but does this sound like the right thing for us to do in terms of, you know, taking the equity out of the rental property in 5 years and then paying off our primary residence so we're, literally debt-free and just really looking at the minimum required distribution?
How much do you make a year now?
Our adjusted gross income is probably about $240,000 a year.
And will you have a pension of any sort?
No, it's just the retirement accounts that I have here.
And will your wife have a pension of any sort?
No, she'll be relying upon the distribution of these as well. She's a little bit younger than me, so she probably would retire in maybe 8 years.
I guess the stock market allocation doesn't concern me. But what I kind of big question mark in my head is, if this rental you're planning on selling in 5 years to pay off the house, so the house can be paid off in 5 years, why don't you just sell it today?
Because it's got the yield of 6% on it, and he's using depreciation. Is that correct? Vince?
Yes. Yeah, we're profiting about $10,000 a year.
So okay. So here's the answer to the question there. I don't know whether I'd sell it in 5 years or not.
What do you owe on your primary residence?
About $355,000, and in 5 years that would be just slightly under $200,000.
Well,
we have a 15 year mortgage, which is about, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
Over 10 years.
So based on your income of $240,000 a year, your standard of living, this is just rough looking at that. If you pay off that rental, the house, you most certainly should do that. So you get rid of that debt, and it actually would make the overall portfolio a little bit more conservative. Your account balances of $390,000 in your IRAs and 401ks. In 5 years at the current rate would probably, you know, at a decent rate increase, and the maximum contribution of $25,000 a year to those should put you at about 650 to 5%, yeah. 30,000. What are you paying on your mortgage?
We're paying, it's $4,000 a month.
$4,000 a month. 48,000. Yes. And your social security is $2,700.
I mean, I see one of the if I were in your situation, one of the challenges I see is that you've got a strategy that's going to say in 5 years you're going to pull a trigger. You've got a 5-year hold on that rental property, essentially. And for me, a 5-year hold on real estate stocks is a little short for me.
Yeah, maybe. So you're thinking, why wouldn't you just do it today and call it a day?
My concern is what happens if you're about to retire and the markets, you can't. I mean, you know what it's worth today. And if your goal is to
you're trying to mitigate risk and you can do it today, then you should probably do it today. Is that the point,
yeah.
Scott?
Yeah. And then take that equity, pay down that mortgage.
Right now.
You're not getting any tax benefits from the rental because your income's too high.
Right. It kind of leads to the second part of my question is, you know, I moved the target retirement funds, you know, 120,000 to the 2015 fund, which really flipped my equity bond.
Okay.
65 bonds and 35 equities, just because in the last few weeks, what I've seen going on with the market and just, you know, at my age, I've seen the market flip a few times.
Vince,
so
you're making an argument as to why you should actually sell that rental and pay down the house, because While you're making the portfolios more conservative in the market, which you shouldn't be, because at age 70, when you go to retire, you still have a life expectancy of 16 years. And your wife is 8 years younger than you. So hers is 28 years, being a female. You're addressing risk on one part of the portfolio, which is what shows up on a statement with numbers, and you're ignoring the other part of the portfolio, which is the...
which has debt on it.
Which is the debt and the value of the rental property. So in order to make this all work right, I agree with Scott. I would look at selling the house now, paying down the rent, taking that, paying down the primary mortgage. The primary mortgage is what's going to stop you from actually retiring comfortably.
$4,000 a month.
At $4,000 a month. That's the equivalent of about pre-tax dollars of about $60,000 a year coming in. And then you look at your Social Security benefits of $2,700 a month approximately. And then you look at your portfolio.
A little higher than that if you wait till 70.
And then you look
at it's actually about 3,800
if
I age 70.
Yeah. Oh, 38. Okay.
Plus my wife.
Yep. Well, yeah. So I think you should sit down and visit with a financial advisor. I think that you've underallocated equities in your portfolio, moving it to the 2015 target date. And you got to think about, it's not just your retirement, it's both of you, and the age difference between you and your wife is extremely relevant in this situation.
Yeah, because that's my concern, is looking over the next 5 years. I mean, I look to put another $200,000 towards my retirement accounts over the next 5 years. So, you know, that's the other question, is where do I put this $200,000? Do I...
Your 401k.
You're saying I should look more long-term. Yeah, and the 401k and cash.
I mean, the day you're going to retire, you're not spending it all. So you're a life... I mean, your time horizon is actually very long with your money.
Yeah.
So you're giving us conflicting... you're conflicted because one of your assets you're actually planning on 5 years and you're not mitigating the risk, and the other one you're over mitigating the risk on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All righty.
Interesting.
More food for thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Sit down with a qualified advisor.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, Vince.
I appreciate it.
All right. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Well, unfortunately, this is all the time we have. We are here every week at the same station. And if you haven't been to our website in a while, HansomMcLean.com, there's some great tutorials, articles, guides on our learning library. We'll see you next week. This has been Hansom McLean, soon to be Allworth Financials, Money Matters.
This program has been brought to you by Hanson McLean Advisors, a registered investment advisory firm. Any ideas presented during this program are not intended to provide specific financial advice, and you should consult your own financial advisor, tax consultant, or estate planning attorney to conduct your own due diligence.